From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Marker Report. It's the 14th day of May 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzolo. He's at Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Bruce Bostard, the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. In agricultural news, U.S. EPA says factories and power plants will be subjected to the greenhouse regulations, and that might just push legislators to support the climate bill introduced this week. And Colin Peterson says he won't support increased funding for the USDA food stamp programs until issues related to childhood obesity are addressed. Dave Dickey will have details of these stories shortly. Then in the second half hour of our program on many of these stations and always online at willag.org, we'll discuss the 2012 Farm Bill with Mary Kay Thatcher of the American Farm Bureau Federation. There's some interesting things in there, too, about HSUS. And along the way today, we'll hear from Gary Schnitke, not quite about the acre program, but there's some advice there about that June 1 decision, but rather today about the new webinars on the FarmDoc website. And it all happens on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
In Chicago on this Tuesday afternoon, I'm listening to the Bates. On this Friday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby May contract, a settlement price today at 463.5, down 7.5 cents. July at 471.5, down 7.5. And September, 488.75, down 7.25. May corn futures, 356.75, down 9.75. July at 363, down a dime. September corn, 370.25, 9.5 cents lower. December down 9.380. March futures at 392.5, down 8.75. May beans now, 948, down 12.5 cents. July at 953.5, down 11. August at 947.5, down 11 cents. September, 931.5, 10.5 lower. And November beans at 926.25, down 9 cents. May bean meal, 282.20, down 220. May bean oil at 37.17, down 63. June live cattle, 93.25, 232.5 lower. May feeders at 110.22.5, down a buck 50. And hogs at 88.20, down 22.5 cents. This is the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil June futures, $71.47 a barrel, down $2.93. Ethanol at $1.61.9, 2.5 4-tenths of a cent lower. Natural gas at $4.31.6, down 2 3/10. And the June heating oil at $2.05.7 of a cent, down 7 4/10. Gold futures at $1,227.40 an ounce. A settlement price there down $1.40, and the Dow now at 10,577, just about 205 points lower. The Goldman Sachs at 501.73, down 17.84 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like. It says that moderate flooding has been reported along the Illinois and the Mississippi rivers in western Illinois, with minor flooding of rivers in near flood stage and other locations in southern Illinois and some northern locations in both of the states. A storm system will move from the southern plains toward the Great Lakes late this weekend with moderate to locally heavy rainfall. The rain could expand flooding and prolong interruptions to the planting of soybeans, of course. Warmer and drier conditions will improve emergence and development and allow for planting to resume beginning around the middle of next week. We'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour. State climatologist Jim Angel will be here to discuss that. And then in the second half hour of our program again, we'll talk with Mary Kay Thatcher. She is a public relations person with the American Farm Bureau Federation and based in Washington, D.C. That second half hour we call The Farming World and shows up on many of these radio stations.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. We're on the line today with Mike Zuzulo to take up the agricultural futures markets. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana. How are you, Mike?
Hey, doing good, Todd. How about you?
Oh, well, you know, as long as I get the days right, I'm doing okay. Well, you know what? Bates is on Tuesday mornings, and the underwrite or the advertisement, I suppose, for some of them is awfully close to one for Wayne Nelson. He's on Tuesday, and I just had it in the back of my mind.
It happens all the time.
Yeah, what, the back of my mind?
Exactly.
that's the deal. Okay, so the back of the mind. Hey, you know what? I said something to you just before we came on the air, because you like wheat, my friend, and it was down 39 cents in the July contract. Why is that the case? And then there's some funky things going on in the basis contracts for wheat across the nation. Have you been following any of that, too?
Yeah. And in fact, the listeners should know, before we go on the air, we get about 30 seconds to talk. And, you know, with wheat, you're like, I'm sure you want to talk about wheat since it was down so much this week. You guys do put up with a lot with people like me, you know that, and I appreciate that. The basis side of the soft red wheat has been very, very friendly for the producer. It's been narrowing. It's been coming in. Several things going on there. The very historically low acreage numbers are probably the number one factor. I think there's also some concerns about disease pressure out there in this cool, wet spring that we've seen to be running into, Todd. So I think that the basis with the soft red wheat is going to continue to be probably the bright light in the wheat complex, and the you know, Chicago wheat will probably be the greatest likelihood would be that it would be the leader to the upside if it has any cash issues that would translate into the soft red faster than the spring or the hard red. So something we need to watch as we get closer to harvest and we get some early harvest numbers back and find out if we have any real disease problems and pressure out there. But overall, that's about the best I can put on the wheat for this week. There's three things that really bother me in the wheat, and unfortunately, with the USDA report and the weekly export sales, it's kind of resumed its mantle as the fundamental leader to the downside. And currency issues with the dollar, the euro, that continues to promote the same type of mindset. Seasonally, not only was this week's weekly export sales pretty poor, but seasonally we really kind of drop off for the rest of the marketing year in terms of potential new buyers in the export market. And the other thing I've been thinking about is if I were a commodity trading fund and I were going to go out and pick up more longs of something in the grains, and it probably wouldn't be wheat at this point because we are, after all, getting ready to put, you know, new crop harvested bushels on the Northern Hemisphere supply tables. I would probably be choosing, if I were a commodity trading fund, a corn or bean long at this point. So we've had recently the wheat be supported by commodity trade fund buying or short covering. I think that's probably going to diminish from here on out, at least until July, unless there's some real big crop or weather problems that we don't know about yet.
And then one other thing, given the small number of acres of soft red winter wheat that are out there, the total supply table, because there's a pretty good size carry-in, if I remember right.
Right.
Total supply table doesn't look terribly bad as long as the crop comes to fruition. Is that right?
No, that's exactly right. They came out with a 2010-2011 estimate this week of 283 million bushels. Last year was 404 million bushels. So we're down a lot in acres, but they're also thinking the yield's going to be there. I think, again, it goes back to the disease pressure and what's actually, you know, what we actually combine. With when you have such low acres, that's where you could have bullish surprises come, and that's where I would think that if you were a wheat trader, you'd probably want to be long Chicago, short KC, or long Chicago and short the spring wheat, especially after we get through this wetter time period in the northern plains and see them dry out as well.
And why is the basis closing up for soft red winter wheat?
I think primarily the acres and the disease pressure being factored into the trade, and also it's been so wide that producers just aren't encouraged to sell. And forward contracting from the people I talk to, the clients I've spoken with around the Corn Belt, forward contracting has been next to non-existent this year because the basis has been so wide, and the wheat really hasn't jumped up in price like we've been used to the last couple, 3 years. So I think maybe you're also getting the elevators to come in and tune in a little bit more to try and get some wheat bought before we actually get harvesting.
And for the uninitiated, hard red and soft red in spring and durum, they're not completely interchangeable, and oftentimes they're not interchangeable at all. So
right.
They're different classes of wheat, and soft red's traded in Chicago, hard red in Kansas City, although hard red can be used for, I think, some soft red.
Yes, you can mix them and you can blend them. And, you know, it's funny you say that because I was talking with a good friend that's a pretty large-sized commercial trader in wheat especially, and he said, you know, you've got an issue with quality still in the corn market, but the wheat quality is still pretty good as far as a hard red wheat quality goes, and they're not real nervous about the quality issues this coming year. So the past few years, we've seen actually quite a bit more blending going on, either because we had low supplies of one or we had poor quality of one and not the other. So maybe we'll have more of a normal, typical blending and milling type season this year.
And the problem they end up with, especially in pastas, is that when they substitute, for instance, hard red into those pastas mix, it changes the taste of the pasta just a little bit, and folks don't like it when things change.
Well, coming from Italian descent, you just can't have sticky or gooey pasta. You just throw it all out.
All right. So we talked long enough about wheat. What do you see in the corn and the soybean markets? Why the drop today?
I think midday really took a lot of air out of the balloon. I think there's probably some potential short covering that could come about midday, but we saw a real big switch, or a significant switch, I should say, in the midday weather updates. It looks a lot warmer, looks a lot drier in the 6 to 10 day. National Weather Service 6 to 10 day just came out before we went on the air. It's also calling for above normal temps, below normal precip in Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio as well, above in Iowa, normal in precip in the Iowa area. You had that, and then you had the May futures expire in across the board. Only the May soy meal went off the board at a premium. The rest of them, the corn, the beans, and the wheat, they went off at a pretty steep discount to the now lead month July. I think those two things really didn't afford any short covering to occur, especially when the crude oil and the outside markets weren't given any short covering signals either.
Any final word from you today?
I think the one thing we want to watch here is we saw the summer hogs and summer cattle contracts close below their 40-day moving averages today for the first time since the end of 2009, first of 2010. That could be a pretty decent-sized sell signal, so maybe selling any kind of recoveries would be a good idea next week.
Yeah, that's not something that's really too unexpected as we moved into this marketplace. We heard about that earlier in the year, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And I just talked to a guy in Stinnett, Texas. He just sold his couple potloads of heifers for feeders, 750 pounds for $1.10. He said it was the second time in 25 years he's done it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd. Be good.
You too. Bye-bye. That is Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Friday afternoon. If you'd like to hear him again, you can do that on our website at willag.org. Sign up for the podcast, the newsletter, your Commodity Week pre-opening, opening, and closing mark reports, our midday, everything's there. And it's all free at willag.org.
Leonard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Leonard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Leonard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
Dave Dickey is here now with today's Ag News.
In agricultural news, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency ruled yesterday that factories and power plants will be subject to greenhouse gas regulations, a major step that could push polluters and lawmakers to support the climate bill unveiled this week in the Senate. The EPA rules would subject power plants, factories, and oil refineries that emit 75,000 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent to regulations beginning in January of 2011. Regulated polluters would include big coal-fired power plants and heavy energy users such as cement, glass, and steel makers. Waste landfills and factories that are not already covered by the Clean Air Act that emit at least 100,000 tons of greenhouse gases a year would get a six-month extension and would not be required to be regulated until July of 2011. Under the rules, polluters would at the least have to get permits showing they are using the best available technology to cut emissions when building new plants or modifying existing ones. The chairman of the House Agriculture Committee says he will not support any increase in funding for the food stamp program unless possible contributions to obesity are addressed. House Agriculture Committee Chairman Colin Peterson says, quote, "There will be pressure to spend more on nutrition programs, but I am reluctant to do that if we do not fix the underlying problems." Peterson also told reporters, quote, "I do not believe the solution to obesity is spending more money on fruits and vegetables. That might be part of the solution. I don't know where we would get the money to do that." Brazil's JBSSA, the world's largest beef producer, posted a first-quarter profit today, reversing a year-earlier loss on a surge in sales and cost-cutting at its U.S. unit. Net income totaled $55.9 million, compared with a net loss of $322.7 million a year earlier. Sales jumped 35.4% year-on-year. And U.S. beef has gained market share on Australian beef in South Korea as consumer confidence in U.S. imports grows. Korea International Trade Association statistics show South Korea's U.S. beef imports rose 57.5% to 19,230 tons in January to March, compared to 12,209 in the same period last year. South Korea's overall beef imports rose 19% in the first quarter compared to a year ago. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Mark Report and Commodity Week. That second program will be up on our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. By about 6 o'clock this Friday evening, our guest today, when we record at 4:30, will be Jerry Golke. Be sure to visit willag.org and listen to Commodity Week there or on one of these many radio stations. Now, up next, you know, the FarmDoc website from the Ag Economist at the University of Illinois has been effectively pushing the technological outreach envelope since it began. I'll have more on something that's new and useful there for farmers to try, and a bit on the Acre program. FarmDoc stands for Farm Decision Outreach Center. It's a website started a few years ago so that the Ag Economist at the University of Illinois could deliver information directly to end users, mostly farmers, landowners, and farm managers. It quickly evolved into a way to deliver tools and information. The first tools were downloadable Microsoft Excel spreadsheets that farmers could use as templates and calculators for all types of farm management. Then came the online calculators and comparison spreadsheets for things like crop insurance. And now there are webinars. It's a way for the AgEcon specialist, like Gary Schnittke, to post educational material in a PowerPoint with hot links and his voice. He just did one on the government's Acre program.
Yeah, we make these Acre webinars. Actually, they start out with a PowerPoint overhead set, and we put animation in it. And then we have a plug-in or a program in additional to PowerPoint called Articulate that you voice it over. And as we get more experience with those Acre that piece of software and the webinar format, we can do a lot of things with animation and voicing over that make hopefully them interesting and fast-paced, and you can always repeat them so that you can see the information.
That ability to go back and listen and watch again is more than just a nicety.
Yep, the webinars are built such that each slide or has a button off to the left, and you can click and do them over again. So I think that's a nice setup, I believe.
a setup you can experience for yourself if you have internet access. Just visit the FarmDoc website at farmdoc.illinois.edu. There you'll find several webinars. Schnitke's latest is a review of the ACRE program. It's projected 2009 and 2010 crop year payouts and offers some insight into whether or not a farmer should sign up for the program for the first time this year. Well, here's a hint. The answer is yes for all the Corn Belt states. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. Please do visit our website. The address is willag.org. That's W-I-L-L-A-G.org. There you can hear all of our agricultural programming anytime you like. Or you can dial this number. It's 217-333-3434. We call that our mobile analyst portal. We post a few of the numbers from either the opening or the closing market reports, a bit of analysis there, at about 10:15 and 3:15 daily. The number 217-333-3434. Just a voicemail, but it's always there, and you can pick up your phone and dial that number. Speaking of phones, the folks up at the Ludlow Co-op elevator were out of the office this afternoon. I forgot about that, but I'll bet that I've got somebody on the line from the Andersons from right here in Champaign County. Good afternoon to you. Thanks for filling in on short notice today.
Hey, Todd. It's Matt Payne.
Oh, hi, Matt. Good to talk with you. Well, we've got a couple minutes here. Matt, tell me about cash movement. Was there a day this week that things moved for you?
Actually, we had a lot of trading Tuesday and Wednesday. Thursday and Friday of this week have been very mild.
So they got everything done on a couple of days. You think they'll be back into the market if it pops?
Absolutely. I think guys are still trying to finish up some 09 sales and then looking forward as well to fall and Jan bids as well.
Is that the right thing to do in your mind?
Absolutely. I think anytime we get some rallies right now, you got to take advantage just because essentially most of the U.S. corn and bean crop is planted. So, and being that it's May 14th, you know, unless there is a major weather issue, we think it's probably going to be stagnant for the next couple of weeks.
Are you of the mind that next year, the further out we get, the worse the prices will be?
Not necessarily. I'm never one to say it's going to be one way or the other a year in advance, but the way trends are going, it does look to be more negative than positive.
And what are your bids for the day?
Right now we are 351 cash for corn, June delivery 353, fall 350, Dece 360. For bean cash, 941, June 943, fall 886, and December $9.
Hey Matt, thanks so much for helping me out today.
Thanks.
Matt Payne is with the Andersons. He's right there at their Champaign facility in Champaign County. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Friday afternoon. In 2 minutes, we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast. Jim Angel will be here. He's state climatologist from the Illinois State Water Survey.
It's National Buttermilk Biscuit Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1686, Gabriel Fahrenheit was born. Fahrenheit was a German physicist who invented the Fahrenheit temperature scale thermometer. It was the first thermometer to use mercury instead of alcohol, which also extended the temperature range of thermometers. In 1853, Gail Borden applied for a patent for condensed milk. But it was not until the Civil War, when troops needed milk products that did not spoil, that condensed milk became popular. In 1919, Henry John Heinz died. Heinz was founder of the H.J. Heinz Company and creator of its slogan, 57 Varieties. Heinz was inspired by an advertisement he saw while riding on an elevated train in New York City of a shoe store boasting 21 styles. Heinz picked 57, more or less, at random. In 1985, the first McDonald's restaurant in Des Plaines, Illinois, became the first fast food museum. And in 1994, the FDA announced that the Flavor Saver tomato, a biotech-developed food, was safe. It was the first time that a commercially grown, genetically engineered food was deemed safe for human consumption. But the Flavor Saver did not prove profitable due to the need for specialized harvest equipment and shipping crates. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. On this Friday afternoon, Jim Angel joins us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Good afternoon to you, Jim. He's at the Illinois State Water Survey. Thanks, Jim, for being with us today.
You're welcome.
And what do you see for the weekend?
Well, for us here in central Illinois, it's going to be very nice. Highs around 70 and lows in the upper 40s, lower 50s. And that'll be true today, tomorrow, and into Sunday. Now, by Sunday, we may start seeing some rain move into the area, and that'll continue with a chance of rain from Sunday through Tuesday, although I'm not sure the amounts are going to be that spectacular. I think it's just going to be more like rain showers and things like that. Now, southern Illinois is going to be fairly wet this weekend. In fact, there's a large blob of, that's a technical term, of rain moving out of Missouri, kind of in Illinois, south of I-70. So they're going to see some rain, and the forecast is rain all weekend with the potential amounts of 1 to 2 inches, it looks like.
And then will they dry out next week?
Well, yes. After we get into next week, by about Tuesday or Wednesday, it'll start to turn warmer and drier with lots of sunshine. And the 6 to 10 day and the 8 to 14 day forecast both show us as being above normal on temperatures and below normal on precipitation. So we should have some nice drying weather.
Do you agree with those forecasts? And what does above normal mean? How far above?
Well, let's see, for this time of year, we get about an inch of rain a week, and temperatures, you know, highs were probably around 70, low around 50. So it could be kind of warm, kind of like what was yesterday. That was a little bit on above normal on the temperature side.
Anything else in the forecast that we need to know about before I let you go for the day?
No, I think that's it.
All right, Jim, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Jim Angel is state climatologist. He's at the Illinois State Water Survey, located right here in Urbana-Champaign at the University of Illinois campus. He's filling in this afternoon for Steve Hilberg. That's the director of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center that belongs to NOAA. Steve out of the office today. You can always hear Jim again and the weather forecast on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. And just about a minute and a half, we'll start the farming world here on many of these radio stations. Our guest this afternoon is Mary Kay Thatcher, and she's with the American Farm Bureau Federation out of Washington, D.C. She'll talk to us a bit about agricultural policy and the Farm Bill 2012. And there's some interesting things in our conversation about the HSUS. That's the Humane Society of the United States. The farming world comes to you each and every day as the second part of the Closing Market Report. If you can't hear it on your radio station, you can always listen to it online at willag.org. That's willag.org.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Mary Kay Thatcher. She's the Director of Public Policy at American Farm Bureau Federation and located in Washington, D.C. Ms. Thatcher, thank you so much for being on the program. Farm Bill is, well, beginning to heat up despite the fact that it will be 2012 when Congress really probably gets around to trying to put it into place. What are the primary policy functions at AFBF, the American Farm Bureau Federation, that you're following at this point?
Well, certainly the budget is going to dictate largely our next farm bill, and that's why Colin Peterson has thought maybe it's good to start early. I think whether you believe you're going to have a Democratic-controlled House and Senate when you come back after November, or if the House might flip, that regardless, you're going to have people who are interested in this budget deficit finally. And if that's the case, you're probably going to have a budget reconciliation bill early in 2011 where they would come to the committees and say, cut 5% of your budget or 8%, 10%, who knows what the right percentage is. But certainly agriculture won't be exempt from them. So we probably will have to start in 2011 because going in and trying to cut that much money out of the budget in 2011 and thinking you're not going to have to reopen the farm bill to do it is crazy. And the worst thing would be to rewrite it once in 2011 and rewrite it once in 2012. But depending on how much money we have is going to say a lot about what kind of farm policy we can afford in the future.
Can you divide up the farm policy for me? Because this farm bill takes up so much more than just that's related directly to the land. And maybe, I don't know whether you have the percentages, but give me an idea of where the budget splits out on all the types of things that operate USDA.
Well, we are now exceeding 70% of the USDA budget that is spent for nutrition programs. That's food stamps, women, infant, and children, school breakfast, school lunch, those types of programs, 70 cents out of every dollar. Then you've got the rest of the programs, be it farm programs, crop insurance, conservation, research, energy, credit, that take up the other 30%. So when you really look at the farm bill and the large pots of money, you obviously don't have a bunch of money in the loan rate target price category because with prices, it doesn't look like we're going to trigger those for a few years. So if you're looking for big pots of money in which to fundamentally change current farm policy, you have to look at the direct payments or at crop insurance or at conservation. And much of conservation is kind of tough to look at because, you know, off the cuff, I'm going to tell you probably more than half of the budget is for the Conservation Reserve Program. And we and everyone else have argued long and hard that once you have a 10-year contract with farmers for CRP, you don't break that contract. So those are the three pots of money that people will be looking at if they indeed wanted to fundamentally change the farm bill.
Well, it seems that the administration is, while they said they weren't really going to do much with the farm bill, at least at one point last week or the week and a half ago, they turned around and already have started to discuss revamping the farm bill in unique and different ways and looking at the revenue assurance programs and the insurance programs and finding different ways to fund them. What do you think of that, and what does AFBF to say about it?
I think they'll be very involved. They said they weren't going to submit a bill on their own, but certainly they would submit ideas and concepts, and I'm sure they will do background information on how is the ACRE program working and how is the SURE program, the disaster program, working and what could we do to further enhance crop insurance. I'm sure they will have many ideas, but what I think is very clear is that this administration will focus largely on rural development issues. If you listen to Tom Vilsack, either before the House Ag Committee a couple of weeks ago or in all the speeches he gives around the country, he is big on let's look at rural communities and what we can do there, and not real big on let's look at production agriculture. So that will be something. But again, you know, whether it's this administration or any other administration, they can make all the recommendations they want to the Hill, but it's the Senate and House Ag Committees that actually draft the bill. So it's sort of like the budget that comes up every year. You may not like what this administration or some other administration has sent, but for all intents and purposes, it's somewhat dead on arrival, and it's the Hill that actually writes the bill.
Well, let's take up some individual things that our farm listeners will be very interested in. AFBF have a position on direct payments?
Well, right now, our position is that we largely like the farm bill that's in place. We think it's working pretty darn well, and I think the question's going to come in on some people believe, and certainly this is true, direct payments are sometimes hard to justify, hard to keep, because people say, why would you pay farmers to not plant or to plant some other crop, et cetera? I think what they failed to take into account is that, you know, we did that somewhat with the direct payments years ago to be able to give farmers flexibility to plant what they wanted to plant versus have to look at the rates from the government. And we also did it because it's very, very compliant with World Trade Organization negotiations. And while that Doha negotiation is dead as a doornail right now, the fact is it will be back. And at some point, we'll have to make cuts in those trade-distorting programs, the things that we classify as amber and blue box. Well, direct payments are green box, and they won't have to be cut to meet international obligations for a long time. So there are people out there who don't like direct payments who are working diligently to try to get rid of them, and they haven't really decided. Do you go to an acre-type program? Do you go to an expanded crop insurance program? What do you really do with it? We've got our state farm bureaus talking about that in a big way, trying to figure out where they want to go. But as of today, our policy says that we think the current farm bill is working pretty well.
You mentioned acre. Take that up. Do you think that that looks like it's going to work well for producers who have enrolled in it? And they're, I don't remember the exact number, but I think it was about 13% to 15% in the Midwest or the Corn Belt that enrolled in that program.
Right. Not a real high percentage of folks that went in. I suspect that after they saw it work for a year, we'll have a little greater participation this year. Certainly, if you got into it as a wheat producer, you did fairly well. Corn and soybeans probably would have done pretty well this year, too. Doesn't really work for cotton and rice. I think the question with acre is, unless the participation rate really jumps, that people either say, it's not worth it, let's get rid of it, or they'll say, let's expand it. And instead of going from a trigger where it gets triggered at a statewide level, maybe we can trigger it at a countywide level or a regional level to make it closer to home. So I suspect it won't live as is, but it could be amended if people decide they want to put additional funding into it.
Universities or land grants have been big supporters of the program, thinking that it works fairly well to help farmers out in their in leveling their revenue when they need it. I was a bit surprised, I guess, personally, that last week, I think it was the Iowa Farm Bureau that came out and said, this is not a program we like or want.
Well, and that's what they're for their discussion for the next time. I think, you know, you have to figure out, do you want to be covered at kind of a whole farm level, or is it important to you, for example, with crop insurance, to be able to insure just your corn acres or just your bean acres? And the same kinds of arguments are going to occur in the crop insurance program in the next farm bill. People are going to say, can we afford to go to a whole farm revenue program? And you'll find many people on the Hill that will say, you know, we should just be out there for producers for real disasters. And, okay, so if you suffer a winter wheat total loss, but you have bumper crops and soybeans, then should we really be coming in with government help? And there's certainly many, many ways to look at that. But those are the kinds of, you know, 20,000-foot philosophical discussions that will obviously go on between now and whenever we finish this next farm bill.
All right, next topic. Let's take up some of the other things that might be of interest to WTO and the farm bill. For instance, Brazil continues to win cases against cotton in the WTO. That's one that the WTO, the World Trade Organization, says does not fit. Can you explain how that works or why it is the case and what implications that might have as the farm bill debate ensues in the coming months?
Well, the Brazilian took a case against us in the WTO saying that our cotton subsidies exceeded what we were allowed under current negotiations. And through a couple of years of deliberations now, they did indeed finally win, and they agreed that they understood that this wasn't something the administration could overturn and could fix to make us in compliance, and that it was going to have to wait till the next farm bill. And so until then, we're paying the Brazilians about $150 million a year, presumably through 2012. But, you know, the difficult thing is that the Brazilians, in essence, will have a seat at the table when we're writing the next farm bill because they found us to be out of compliance, or they went to the WTO and they found us. So there will have to be some changes, both in the cotton program and probably the GSM 102. It's an export credit type program, in order to bring us back into compliance in the next farm bill.
Is $150 million enough of an incentive to make the Senate and the House set up and pay attention to it?
Well, yes, because really this, quote, deal between the Brazilians and the U.S. was only cut until that point in time because they understood, you know, they had to wait. But beyond that, they would come back if we didn't fulfill what we said we would do in these negotiations. They'll come back and take us to the WTO again, and we'll have another litigation on our docket. So we've got to be able to do something. And the other thing is they have the ability to come back and retaliate against us. And what they do is they don't retaliate just against cotton. They retaliate against other agricultural products. They retaliate against small business. They took on some of our intellectual property rights. So there is plenty of effort and plenty of kind of spreading the pain across the U.S., I think, probably for them to make their point.
So a foregone conclusion, you think, at this point that those programs will be changed or eliminated then?
Well, I don't think they'll be eliminated. You know, it's a little questionable yet what you do to the GSM 102 program to make it completely legal. But I think without a doubt, you're going to have to at least reduce both of the programs, the benefits of both of those programs.
What does GSM 102 do?
It provides export credits so that if we're competing with some other country to send an export to China or somewhere in Asia, anywhere, we can provide a little bit of credit to make our product more competitive with another country's. And other countries also use those. Mostly, to tell you the truth, export credits are used by the Europeans and by the U.S. But it's in order to help us be more competitive.
Is it a line of credit that the country gets to use, or is it actually money that gets put into the
It's top? Actually a low-interest type of a loan.
All right. Next topic. Let's move on to Animal ID. National Animal ID has been a big topic and remains a big topic. It's controversial depending on which side of the fence I suppose you stand on. Tell me about the program itself, what it's supposed to do, and then maybe some of the controversy that surrounds it, please.
Well, the thought was that Animal ID would allow us to trace back animal health issues in a very timely manner. If you got foot and mouth disease or you got swine flu or some of those things, that it would be a quicker trace back and that we wouldn't have to do as much really looking for these animals. And, you know, this is really a sort of a sector by sector initiative because if you look at the swine industry, if you look at the sheep industry, the dairy industry, those folks already have those animals. Well, the poultry industry and the swine industry, they don't really have to tag each animal individually. They just have to keep them in lots and move them by lots. And, you know, maybe there's one tag for 100 hogs. So it's not hard to do. They're already in a barn. It's not expensive, et cetera. The problem comes in when you go to beef cattle. Because we raise beef cattle oftentimes out in pastures. You get out in the West, you may not see that cow for several months. And to individually tag each animal, the cost is about $6 a tag, runs up and is pretty expensive pretty quickly. So I think that finally what this administration has come to is to say, you know, we're not doing very well in moving this animal ID process along. Let's stop where we are. Let's not have us make any more progress at the federal level. And let's turn it over to the states and say, as long as animals just move intra within the state, you can regulate those animals. You can decide what to do. Once they move interstate, they go across state lines, then they're going to have an animal ID. But states ought to figure it out. Well, you know, we think it's great that they understand that what they had wasn't working. I think it's going to be very difficult to make this kind of an approach work, too, because you know, theoretically, you could have states just say, I don't want to play. Well, what are you going to do about that from the federal level?
You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. This afternoon, we're talking with Mary Kay Thatcher. She's the Director of Public Policy at American Farm Bureau Federation in Washington, D.C. More in a moment.
Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the Commerce Department today says that sales at U.S. retailers rose more than expected in April, lifted by a surprise gain in motor vehicle purchases. Total retail sales rose 0.4%, following an upwardly revised 2.1% surge in March. Sales in March were previously reported to have increased 1.9%. Retail sales have now increased for 7 straight months. Core retail sales, which exclude autos, gasoline, and building materials, fell 0.2% after increasing 0.7% in March. The euro hit fresh 18-month lows today as concerns intensified that fiscal austerity measures in the eurozone would dampen a fragile recovery and spark social unrest. After rising to around $1.31 following last week's agreement of an emergency $1 trillion anti-crisis package, the euro has been under pressure for most of this week. The euro has fallen more than 12% against the dollar and yen this year, making it the biggest loser among major currencies. And JCPenney's today says its first quarter net income more than doubled as sales improved across most categories. Net income rose to $60 million, or 25 cents per share, in the quarter ending May 1st. That compares with $25 million, or 11 cents per share, in the year-ago period. Revenue rose 1.2% to $3.93 billion. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. This afternoon, we're talking with Mary Kay Thatcher. She's the Director of Public Policy at the American Farm Bureau Federation. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We had just moved to the topic of animal ID when we last spoke with Ms. Thatcher. And maybe we should make a transition at this point, Ms. Thatcher, to animal welfare. The Humane Society of the United States has been a bane in the animal livestock side of the world for the last couple of years. And I say bane because I think that's a name that the animal livestock side would certainly use with them. Tell me about what's been happening with this group, where they came from, and what the problems they have with the livestock side might be and how livestock views them.
Certainly, HSUS has made a real upcoming in the world in the last 5 or 6 years, and I think what they recognized is that they had tried for a good long time to pass federal legislation that would affect animal welfare issues, for the most part, not very successfully. And so several years ago, they sort of changed their idea, and they said, you know what, why don't we go out to ballot states around the country in about half of our states and do have ballot initiatives that are available to them. And let's go, and we think we'll have more luck convincing voters on a ballot than we will state legislators or certainly federal legislators. And so they've done that fairly successfully in several states. They've been able to go to other states and threaten, hey, you know what, we're coming to your state. We intend to spend $3 or $4 or $5 million to defeat you in a ballot initiative. So instead, why don't you join forces with us and do this via legislation, and we'll save ourselves all time and money and effort, et cetera. We anticipate this will continue to happen. They have worked on things all the way from puppy mill type legislation that they're at in Missouri this year to, of course, banning gestation crates and battery cages and veal tethering, et cetera. So we suspect that this state-by-state initiative will continue until the time that they think they have enough states out there where they can come back to the federal government and make the argument, okay, we got 20 states or 30 states out there with varying degrees of legislation. Now we need to make all those legislation. We need to make it uniform here at the federal level. So we know eventually it'll come back here. For the most part, have we dealt with horse slaughter and federal procurement of meats? Yes, but more of their initiative has been at the state level versus the federal level.
Yeah, so they're working diligently, and I suppose it's an organization that it appears that you have to kind of come to the table with at some point because they're working through the legislative process.
Well, they are, and what they do is they threaten states. They say things like, you know what, we're going to come, we're going to spend $4 million in your state, and if you will help us in legislation, we'll give you 10 years to phase out gestation crates. If you don't and you beat us in legislation, then next year we'll take it to a ballot initiative, and we're only going to give you 3 years to phase it out. So they make producers pretty nervous who know they don't have the amount of money to be able to phase out their current production system in 3 years, and they think, well, maybe negotiating is better than anything else. They also are, unfortunately, kind of good at splitting off industries. You know, they'll get the poultry industry to pull out of an agricultural coalition or the pork industry, et cetera. And once you start, you know, splintering in those agricultural industry groups, then they have you. So they are able to do that. They have a tremendous amount of money. They're quite the money-raising machine. In reality, what they really do is to make people believe that they represent the local dog and cat shelters, when indeed they do not.
Right.
Less than one half of 1% of their funding actually goes to helping hands-on animal welfare type issues. Most of it goes into legislative battles and legal battles, et cetera.
Well, I guess in the bottom line, then, it's just the democratic process in order. Whether you like it or don't like it doesn't matter. It's the way it happens, isn't it?
It is. It's a huge threat, though, and it's something I think we're starting to get a handle on. I mean, we're feeling kind of good. You looked at Yellowtail Wine that was going to give a bunch of money to HSUS, and when we went to them and said, do you know what you're doing here? If you want to give money for animal welfare purposes, there are better ways to do it. We had a truck stop that was going to, you know, serve only meat products that were humanely raised. We were able to turn that around. But they have enough money and enough staff. Their staff is about 550 people strong around the country. So lots of people that work only on animal welfare issues. And they have a budget of about $130 million a year. So it's something that we're going to continue to have to work at. But I think we got farmers out there. They're doing YouTube videos. They're speaking at Rotary clubs. They're talking to folks at church. They're getting out the story that HSUS is really another PETA and not something that we should be very trusting of.
Final topic, budget. It's a tight one. We started talking about it, I suppose, up front just a bit when we began this conversation with the Farm Bill. What things are at risk, do you think, under the budget process?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think you got to believe virtually everything other than maybe Department of Homeland Security and Department of Defense would be at risk for budget cuts. It is so out of line that, you know, you just can't tinker around the edges and expect to make any progress. We're now at, you know, somewhere in the range of about 13-14% of our GDP is tied up in deficit. We got Social Security growing and Medicare and Medicaid, and you know, really, there's probably only about 40% of the budget that you can really do something about. So when you're talking about making cuts, unless you're willing to make those tough decisions on things like Social Security and Medicare, it makes it much more difficult. But I think probably you get people looking at Greece right now saying, you know what happened in Greece could happen here. They let things get out of whack, too much running on autopilot over there. And we need to wake up here and make sure that we're doing something about that deficit. So I think people are already waking up to that. It won't happen this year because it's an election year, and it's going to be a very difficult election year in the country. But I strongly suspect that we will have to do something pretty draconian about the budget come 2011.
Mary Kay Thatcher is the Director of Public Policy at the American Farm Bureau Federation. She's been here with us on the Land Grants, the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's
Todd Gleason.